Thanks, Rick. Come on over. Well, you can come on over to the Rick's at the. We have a cool setup. I want to take a picture. I told Rick there would be no pictures.
That's what everybody says.
Yeah, 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 man. But
and then when you get there,
yeah. Condition, right?
Rick, I have a couple of announcements to make. But first of all, let me just say this is really an honor. I've been asking for a long time if you want to come on, and you're always. So you always say, anytime I have time, I'm going to do it. And so you had time, and you made time, and you schlepped all the way out here from Glendale. So I appreciate it.
Mario, it's my pleasure.
Man, I love your stuff. And like I said, your song is the theme for our show and is the opening and closing theme. And then my daughter did some stuff on a little DJ program. So she has the little break music in there.
Beautiful.
But I thought, I hear all these other podcasts with all these other songs, and I always think, man, I really lucked out because I got a guy who just let me use his song. So, and I love it. I think it fits the tone of the show.
Well, I'm glad you like it, and both me and the guy that co-wrote that tune,
Phil,
and played drums, Phil Block. We really appreciate you playing our music.
I love it, man. And so let me set the table here. So we went with a smaller crew today. So I was not going to have a New Orleans piano show without John Sandy.
Oh, thanks, man.
So John Sandy is here. Renee, I actually brought in because there's no way I'm going to be able to run the boards on this one. I you know, you got to know your limitations.
A man's got to know his limitations.
That's right. That's right. And so you know John from such podcasts as the Superiority Complex. And you know that a lot of people don't know this about John. He actually blessed the rains down in Africa. So that's a little.
Well, you lost me completely.
Is that Toto? Is that Toto?
It is Toto.
No.
It is.
Now I get it.
Let me get you.
Okay.
You can get in a little. You want to get in?
Hey,
how's it going? So before we get in and jump in with Rick and ask him a million questions, I want to make a couple of announcements. Friend of the show, Thomas Bailey. You know him. You love him. You can't live without him. I think I stole that from Letterman. Thomas Bailey directed a video for a young lady by the name of Suzanne Santo. And his video actually debuted on KCRW.com. The song is called Ghost in My Bed. And if you're a fan of Americana, I think you might like it, John.
Nice.
And I don't want to play it on here because I don't want to steal any thunder from Thomas. I want everybody to go to KCRW.com or just look up Suzanne Santo, Ghost in My Bed, and check out.
So he did the video.
The video. Wow. And there is a cameo by everybody's America sweetheart, Lauren Nichols, who has been a frequent guest on a show along with Thomas, and she has a little cameo in the video. We have some friends of ours, Paul Frizzley, and his friends have a band called The band is called Red Nine, which is a Star Wars reference. It's a power trio, and they are from Orange County, and they have a new album that's going to drop next week called That Beast. So check that out. Look them up, Red Nine. You'll like them. If you love the rock and roll, if you love the rock and roll that the kids all love, you're going to like it. And then finally, our friend Angel Martinez, who's been on the show several times, his friends have a podcast that he's now joined the cast of. It's called Retro Convo. And you would love it, Renee, because it's all about 90s nostalgia. So they go back and talk about – each week they talk about one thing from their childhood. And I think this last week they talked about the Super Mario Brothers movie.
Okay.
So, but they picked like Ninja Turtles, all this stuff from when they were growing up, and they're a little younger than we are. So, you know, I'm like,
is that crazy?
I remember that.
The 90s nostalgia. The 90s are the new 50s.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right. That's
now
look at Rick rolls his eyes as Rick rolls.
Which is really smart to do, like over the audio portion of our thing. But
we do it all the time.
Did you see that face that Renee just made?
Yeah.
Let me describe it.
He
slapped his forehead, then he rolled his eyes, and they groaned audibly.
My job here is just to describe.
It's like the hearing impaired thing.
I'm distracted by Rick right now because if you look over Rick's shoulder, there's actually a Mike Pence action figure.
Yeah.
Look at that right there. See that thing?
Isn't that crazy? That's so weird.
Oh, look at him. He's about to take away your rights, gay people. Hey, hello.
Every time I see Mike Pence, I think either Race Bannon or Doc Savage.
Race Bannon. What a great reference.
Because they got that white helmet hair, you know.
That is. That's him. It's totally. Is that – who is that? Is that –
It's Cable.
It's Cable.
Okay.
Almost said Cage.
So that's a
Who's Cage? Oh, Luke Cage.
Luke Cage, yeah.
All right. Watch that on Netflix. All right. Okay, enough with that. Okay, let me take a sip of water. Okay. Cover for me, guys.
Okay, is Cable in the Deadpool universe?
Yeah.
All right. Nice cover, huh?
Good cover.
That's pretty good.
We lost Rick there. So, welcome, Rick.
Well, I'm here to learn, you know.
Yeah, what do you want
to
learn, man?
You guys got to teach me all about the...
I think it's going to go the other way around. We're going to learn from you.
Here's the thing about Rick that reminds me of you, John, is that he and I have had these conversations over the years that run the gamut of, I mean, there's nothing Rick doesn't like to talk about. And the thing I love about you, Rick, is you love documentaries. And you're always searching.
Absolutely.
You're always finding new stuff, and you're always out there looking.
It's amazing the world we live in with, you know, access to the internet, so you can see things that would take years to find before. In music and in documentaries and in books and whatever. You know?
It's funny. For me, it's kind of taken away that search element. There was like the thrill of the hunt when you were looking for a certain LP.
But that's weighed by the fact that you don't have to wait 15 years to find a clip of Sparks on Top of the Pops. You just now go, you just push a button and go, oh, there they are.
Yeah.
Wow. Otherwise, you're like, Jesus, I got to find a video. I got to find somebody who knows who that is and where it is and
what
a bootleg.
What songs did Sparks do on Top of the Pops?
Well, their big hit in England was This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us. And that's the clip that John Lennon always says. He's watching TV and he goes, oh my God, they got Hitler on keyboards. Because he had a little mustache. He had a little Oliver Hardy mustache.
Right, that's right.
And he had a scowl. And it's glam rock. It's like Roxy Music with laughs, you know. But you watch this and you can imagine him clicking around and going, oh my God, they got Adolf Hitler on the keyboards.
And they're still around.
They are as good as ever.
They're still doing great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
It's insane.
They're going on like 40 years or something. Yeah, it's amazing.
That's like a Kinks-like run.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an apt putting them in the same sentence, because they're so funny and so smart, like the Kinks, which means that they find their audience like every 15, 20 years. They get a hit and somebody goes, hey, you ever heard of this band?
Yeah.
Because they're so funny and smart, you know. There's just not too many bands that
I'm going to have to look into Sparks. I'll watch them next week. Cut to me next week going, my new favorite band is Sparks. All other bands are inferior.
First thing to do is just to get on YouTube and find them doing This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us on Top of the Pops.
Rick, are you familiar with that?
And they had a very unique visual thing as well. You know, of course, the way when they would perform, but also they got into making videos and stuff, and it was just bizarre.
They were really something. I mean, their sound is kind of like he's got a really high voice, so it's a little bit like Queen before Queen. Mm-hmm. But then for a couple of years there, they're from California, but they're huge in England. They just didn't take off here. When they got to the UK, they really got in on that whole T-Rex, Roxy Music thing. But they were so funny, and it was so off the wall. So they had about a 2-3 year stretch in England where they were huge.
I'm going to have to check them out.
Yeah, and if there's one album you're going to pick up, pick up like Propaganda.
Oh, by the way, speaking of which, last week, apologies to Alexandra Bowser and Brent, who we talked to last week. I had some technical difficulties with Windows. Shout out to the Windows development team for hitting me up on Twitter and helping me fix the problem. I put it out on social media, and they contacted me, and I got to work around the problem. But I wanted to apologize because my episode last week was late, and they were very patient. I told them I promised them it would be out, and it was late. But Brent hit me up on Twitter with a picture of his order of Amazon of the book that you recommended. About the shadow cinema of the
70s. Oh, really? Really?
So
nice.
I said there's one rule on the show, and that is always listen to what John says. If John says, if John recommends it.
You can take that too far. I want you all to walk out the door. I want you to march on Washington.
I love it. There you go, man.
That's
You're
great.
Influencing
that's great.
Hearts and minds.
Wow. Well, one anyway. That's great.
How do you feel?
I don't know.
With
great power comes great responsibility.
I feel like Rick is going to have the same thing today, too. So, Rick, you're here. You're a musician. You cover all the bases. You're not just – like you played some boogie woogie there.
Mm-hmm.
And you're heavy into the New Orleans piano thing.
Mm-hmm.
Your duo Shakedown Mambo, you're heavily influenced by the New Orleans sound. But you've played literally – almost every kind of music in your career, right?
I would say so, but the last maybe 20 or so years I've been concentrating on what was 20 years ago called roots music, meaning, you know, Well, you can't go wrong with New Orleans because pretty much everything comes from there in the beginning. You
That's
know?
The mother root.
It is. It is. It's pretty safe to kind of start there.
Yeah.
But, you know, boogie-woogie and blues and gospel and all that stuff is highly educational as well.
Sure. So you've mentioned to me in the past, but we'll talk about it. You started out playing as a kid. You were playing classical music.
That's right.
That's what you started. Mm-hmm. So what was the first inkling you had of music beyond classical music? What caught your ear that made you say?
I was actually into music before classical music. You know, before I didn't start playing classical music until I was 15 and a half.
Ah, okay.
And before that, I played organ. I played some stuff, but I wasn't really, you know, great at it, you know. But what I was really interested in was the Beatles had come out. I was interested in songwriting.
Okay.
And I really wanted to figure that out because what they were doing was so interesting. And then, of course, because of them, you start finding out about Buddy Holly and people like that. And the two verses, chorus, and a bridge just started really, really, you know, capturing my imagination.
Sure.
And, but, so I'm 11 maybe and listening to music that deeply for songs and how to write lyrics and how to write songs. But then I ran into some people and they were saying, hey, if you want to really do that, you should understand music as deeply as you can. And then that's when I got into classical music because it gets into the nuts and bolts of it.
Sure.
You know, and everything immediately made sense once I started seeing it in the sort of classic sense.
We were just having this conversation the other day. We were talking about, I mentioned to you that you were going to meet my buddy John, and John's a real aficionado of all music, but the one part that John, I wouldn't say afraid, but where you're tentative is you're always like, I don't know about bebop, man. I don't know if I can, because you like swing, you like the New Orleans jazz. And then you were saying that you were talking about you listen to Bill Burr's podcast, mm-hmm. and he's a drummer,
mm-hmm.
and he came out and said,
yeah, he's a amateur drummer, you know, because he's such a great comic. But yeah, he was just saying for years he taught himself, I think, how to play drums for fun. And he was doing pretty much, you know, hard rock or whatever, you know, and really loved that AC/DC, whatever, that kind of simple stuff. And he said recently he got a teacher that started showing him stuff about 4 or 5 years ago, and now they're getting into the bebop era, and he's now completely converted. You know, it's like, oh, man. Because he'd seen people play. I mean, he's from the East Coast. He'd seen, you know, trying to remember the guy's name that played drums with Miles Davis and everybody.
Well, there's Terry Clark. Or no, that Terry Clark was a drummer.
Young guy, the younger guy. You know, he played. Herbie Hancock was in the band, and all those people. I do this with Mario all the time because he.
And look at me, I'm failing you on my own show.
But
I know. If it's jazz, you're it's, like so Mario.
Not Tony Williams.
Ah, okay. I was going to say Philly Joe Jones.
Yeah, the older generation of, and that's who Tony followed.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But yeah, so now Bill is all into Tony Williams, you know. But
wow.
Basically. It took a teacher to show, oh, the left hand's doing this and the right hand's doing that, and these guys, you know, the foot and everything is, you know, ambidextrous or whatever.
Well,
omnidextrous.
Just, what you said now about music making sense once you studied classical, that's immediately what I flashed to, because now all this drumming, like bebop is kind of the source of all modern drumming, really, if you think about it. Because you have guys like Neil Peart, like who are, you know, like those guys are playing. You know, they're taking stuff like Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich, but they're also mixing it with these guys who kind of move the drumming forward. And I feel like you said about the nuts and bolts of drumming, that the classical is where, like, all the Western music came from.
It's like being a dancer and, you know, you can do tap dancing and you can do modern dance and all that, but it always helps to understand, you know, the sort of rigors and also the formulations of ballet or something.
Sure.
Like that, you know,
because
if you can do that, everything else is easier somehow.
Do you still dabble? Do you still play classical at all, or do you?
Oh, man, it's something that's a lifestyle. You know, you have to really dedicate yourself to it. I couldn't play it now. No. I listen to it all the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
Now you're all over the map with your musical taste.
Oh, like, you helped me out with the rap thing. The rap thing I don't really know. Hip hop and rap I'm pretty ignorant about, but you helped me a lot.
But what I did with you is I pointed you to guys that were sampling, like guys like Tribe Called Quest who were sampling the jazz guys.
Mm-hmm.
Because I figure, you know, that's a good jumping off.
That was a bridge.
That's a great jumping off point. And then from there you can go into the heavier stuff, you know, but I feel like I was thinking about this earlier, you know, like people say that, you know, jazz is the big contribution to culture, to world culture from the United States. And I feel like hip hop is every bit as legitimate and, but I think it's grown in what, 30 years, 40 years. It's just exploded and kind of, it's the same thing. And it's almost done the same arc as jazz has in like a shorter period of time where now you kind of have it. It's kind of like we're in like I would say this is like the swing era where it's all commercial. It's pop music now.
Mm-hmm.
Like hip hop is basically pop music now. It's its own genre, but it's now in the popular culture. And I feel like I think the guys that are going to take it to the next level are going to be the guys that either strip it down completely or you know change it in some way that we haven't seen before.
That'd be interesting because, you know, I don't know. Is it a dance form? Do people dance?
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, that's kind of the difference between the – people ask what the difference between rap and hip-hop is, and it's a fine line. But I think that – because there are rap songs all the songs have a good beat. And you, like Dick Clark used to say, has a good beat. You could dance to it.
Because it's all beat.
But it's all beat. Yeah.
Yeah, the vocal is beat too.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you have guys like one of my favorite groups is the Beastie Boys, and you would say, is that hip hop or is that rap? You know, and then you know, it's,
or rock,
or even. Is it? They cross a lot. There's a lot of genres in there.
Punk.
Yeah, exactly. They started out playing punk, so I think it's I think that's a harder music to define than a lot of other genres where you say, well, this guy's hard rock or this guy's bebop or this guy's, you know, a straight swing or New Orleans guy, whatever.
Was it you that told me that great review? I always love that story. Somebody writes a review of the Benny Goodman Band at Carnegie Hall. What was it, 38?
Yeah.
And was it you that told me about that review where the review says that if you tell people, you don't tell them who they're reviewing and the review, and you don't tell them the year. And the review said, too loud, too much bass, too much drums, and you're going, oh yeah, and that was the 38. Somebody's already complaining.
That was not me, but that's great.
It's a real review. Too loud, too much emphasis on drums and bass. And you go, was that last year? No, that was 38. They're complaining already.
So, Rick, have you taken anything under your wing from hip hop? Are you, or who have you listened to?
You know what. I actually wrote a tune, and this was maybe in 2004 or 5. Somebody gave me that Lauryn Hill mm-hmm. record, and it had a lot of – what I liked about it, it had had doo-wop on it. It had all this mm-hmm. different stuff on it, and it was sort of her exploring all those areas, and that was a great bridge for me, and I really liked the record. So I actually wrote a tune – that record made me think of.
Wow, that's awesome.
And at first it had, dare I say it, it had a bit of a rap at the top. It had maybe a 4 or 5 line rap thing. I tried it. It didn't work. But I did keep the lyric, you know, and sang it eventually.
That's
know?
Awesome. So that would be the Miseducation of Lauryn Hill.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a great album.
Yeah.
That's one of the – that's in the pantheon of great –
That's the Sergeant Pepper kind of thing.
Yeah, it's up there.
Hasn't she done more? Because that was such a huge thing.
She retired and then, well, she was huge. She was at the. She could have been the next big thing, and I never understood why.
What was the band she was with?
The Fugees.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Fugees. Man, if I had what hip hop album would for me, my hip hop Sergeant Pepper would be Paul's Boutique by the Beastie Boys,
because
you have
record.
So much sampling and so, there's so much going on, sonically.
You gave me that. I really like that record.
That's a great record. Yeah. Man, see, God, I'm amazing. I'm kidding. I'm really glad you listened to it, though, Rick.
So you're spreading the gospel.
Well, because a lot of guys, you know, a lot of people, you know, you have a, like I was saying earlier, you have a certain style that you're playing in, but I think it's awesome that you're still willing to you know, you've been playing this, you said for 20, you've been playing longer than 20 years, but you've been doing the New Orleans, but I think it's awesome that you're open to new ideas. I feel
you have to be, or you stagnate.
Yeah. I feel like that's what happens with a lot of, or what happens is you get so big that your audience doesn't want you to change, and
then
there's backlash.
I could deal with that.
That takes courage at that point.
You could deal with that kind
that's
of success?
That's a problem you wouldn't mind having.
There you go. A quality problem.
That's right. It's a whole other level of problems.
That's not bad. I'd like to have that problem with this podcast. So tell your friends, guys.
Yeah, really.
Give me that problem.
No, you know what's funny? I just recently started really – we've been doing this show for 4 years now, and, you know, we're over 200 episodes in. And I don't do a lot to promote the show, really. It's kind of therapy for me. I come in, and I have fun, and I talk to people, and we hang out. And it's just in the last couple of – like month or two that I've really said, you know what, I'm going to see if I can – get out there and get people to listen and see if, you know, what they say and get feedback about what we're doing, good or bad. And yeah, I'm horrible at self-promotion, man. So I think podcasting is the perfect avenue for me.
Well, you know, it's weird because it seems like that's the world we live in, as the music business has blown up. It blew, you know, it died, I don't know, 15 years ago, really, you know, except for the pop thing is probably happening, like you said, so big now because who are all those people? They're former Mickey Mouse people. Or
yeah.
They're people that already have millions of people interested in them. That's the only way a record company's going to spend the money to make a record.
That's right. They're all out of the Mickey Mouse Club.
Yeah. Unless you're a guy like Chance the Rapper who has self-produced.
Definitely, yeah. There's exceptions.
But
I'm not saying.
He is the exception and not the rule. Mm. Yeah.
Most people are producing on their own time in their own studio in their own house.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Everybody has to promote themselves, I guess, and I'm terrible at it too. You know, it's like, but that's seems to be the game.
Yeah. And as a working musician, do you kind of resent that? Do you kind of resent the fact that you?
It's just it's a different side of your brain or something that you're required to use. So it takes a while to develop it. Really.
Yeah,
because you know, I'm sure you spent lots of time and effort and to develop, you know. When you were a comedian, you know, you have to go up there and there's a whole.
Well, no. Let's not overstate it. I did 6 months of open mic.
Well, that's more of a comedian than I was, you know? And you've got my eternal admiration because that is like to me the most frightening thing.
It's gotta be the scariest art form.
It has to be
because it's you against the house.
The few times I did it once in Uptown here. I think you came, John.
Yeah, I did.
I did it a couple other places, and most of the time I wouldn't invite anybody to come because I didn't want. I wanted, and what ended up happening, my favorite thing, oddly enough, is there was someone I knew from, I don't know, it's like a bulletin board group or something, and they. We met up, and she was actually already a working comic, but she wanted to, she's like, hey, you know, I think, you know, I've seen you, I think you're funny. Do you want to come and help me write some stuff for me?
Cool.
And that I had a blast doing.
Cool.
Because I got to write jokes for her, and then I watched her perform a couple, and it was great. That was so gratifying to me that something I had written got, you know, laughs, but it was just something that I just didn't, it was a lot of work and I don't think I thought it through. I thought, oh, I'll just give this a try, but no real plan, no real, and you really need, I mean, those guys that are doing, when you see a guy come on, you know, the Tonight Show or whatever with 5 minutes, that could be a year that he's worked on that material and pared it down and got it and just, has all the beats written and all that stuff down. And, you know, but the good comics make it look easy. They make you think that you can do that. It's like a singer.
Sure.
It's like
sure.
a singer.
It's or Fred Astaire. He spends, you know, 4 months making it look like he just rolled out of bed and did it. He says, that's the trick. You have to work at it till it looks like you just, it's rolling right off of you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just like the way you played that, the beginning. We were watching you and it just looked like, like, it doesn't look any different than me when I sit at my daughter's keyboard and goof around, but actual music is coming out.
The difference is music comes out.
Well, Dr. John is like that for me. He looks like he's typing. It looks so effortless. And then it sounds like three guys are playing at once, you know?
I love Dr. John.
He's fantastic.
I, at work, I just annoy the hell out of him because I'm always trying to push Dr. John on people. Like, I used to bring Gumbo when there was a CD player at work. I'd put Gumbo on. Come on, give this guy a chance. And I was like, It's like, don't you have ears?
I guess it's an acquired taste.
I guess it is.
I don't understand because I gravitate to it like you, I mean, immediately. But I guess it's an acquired taste. A friend of mine that I write songs with, who's also an actor, we went and saw at the Hollywood Bowl. We saw the Meters. And Dr. John, and they were the opening. The Neville Brothers. The Neville Brothers were the headliners. Dr. John opened, and Buddy Guy was was the second act. And this is at the Hollywood Bowl. It was beautiful.
Jeez.
And, you know, outside and the whole thing. So it was kind of funny to – I mean, I know it happens all the time. You know, people go to festivals and blues gets played. But every time I hear blues, especially by Buddy Guy or something like that, I think we should be in a smoking nightclub somewhere. And,
sure. That's true. You know, that's true. The Hollywood Bowl is the opposite of that. Yeah.
You know, drinking something strange or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And the show was great. I love Dr. John, but people were talking through his set. You know, it's like,
that kills me.
I don't understand. You know, as people, you gotta listen to. But then Buddy came out, and Dr. John sings more understated. You know,
it's
piano, and he's sitting there, and he's not going to be a visual thing. But Buddy comes out, and he just tore it up. I mean, he was running out in the audience and just doing this incredible show. And the audience really reacted to that. So I think that a lot of times people watch or listen with their eyes.
Yeah, that's right. If there's no flash. Yeah. And yet it would have been a different thing. Yeah, seeing Dr. John like at the Roxy would have been a whole different thing because you're in his lap and you can't help but respond.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
You put my favorite thing is a friend of mine was friends with him
Really?
He played in Washington, D.C. in the early 80s. I have this on cassette because my friend gave this to me. And it was the sound guy made a cassette of Dr. John playing solo piano for 2 hours.
Oh, God. I would love to hear
that. It is unbelievable. And I'm still trying to learn some of this stuff, you know, years and years later.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's like a gift from the gods.
Yeah, and it's so deep. That's
like when John Sandy comes to your work and says, "I have this tape. It's not on CD. It's not on an album. And it's David Bowie at the Santa Monica Civic Center."
Uh-huh.
And he's like, "Here, this is for you." And you just go home and you go, "Wow."
Yeah.
And you feel like you're listening to something that it's weird. And I think that's what, again, going back to the abundance of information out there and the abundance of things you can find. That sort of thing is lost almost, where you feel like this is this is something special. Only a few people know about this, and I have it. And I think the internet has taken a lot of that away.
It's important to have that, I think, for a performer, to have people into them like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm trying to think of the guy's name. He's a songwriter, was big in the 80s. I can't remember his name now, but he was really big. He was like Brian Adams kind of big, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying, and this is probably 82 or something like that, that he was talking about, I got this, really like this songwriter from California and singer Bonnie Raitt. You know? and he said a little while later when she blew up, you know, with the... in, I don't know, 85, 6, something like that, with Nick of Time, and went crazy.
Yeah.
And he was saying, now everybody knows it's not as fun,
man.
It was fun before.
Yeah.
You know?
But it's your band. It's your secret, and you're just passing it around. But they can't make a living on that.
Do you remember what your first paid gig was, Rick?
Oh, God. I'm going to think it was just a bar somewhere,
yeah,
you know, and just playing with a band that you found out through the paper they needed somebody to play, you know, with them, and I, it was just a bar. That's in Garden Grove. I know it's a bar in Garden Grove.
That's awesome. How about how old were you at the time?
I don't know, 19 or something.
So, like, this is 20 years ago. You're in. See what I do?
I'll take it.
See what I do? I pump people up. I'm here to build people up. We build up. We don't tear down.
We love. We
build. We it's build, all about love.
We build up the walls between us and Mexico. Now, listen.
There's a lot of love in this room.
There's a lot of love in this room. So, Rick, would you mind... we'll continue the interview, but you said you had some original stuff to play for us. Would you like
sure.
Would you like to play a number for us now?
Sure.
Well, what's this one called?
I'll play you this thing. It's called NOLA, and it's, of course, like New Orleans, Louisiana. But when I first saw that, I co-wrote it with a friend of mine. He's not around anymore, but his name's Dean Sterling, great guy. And we love the New Orleans thing, and so he said he had an idea. He had a little chorus, and no la la la, and that's all he had. You know, he just sang that. I go, Nola, huh? I didn't know. Well, I didn't remember that Nola means
New Orleans, Louisiana. Yeah,
I thought that's a great girl's name.
you know what's funny? My niece. Her daughter is named Nola.
See? That's a beautiful name.
Yeah.
And I go, hey, can we write a song about a girl named Nola? Yeah, let's do that.
Now, let me ask you, does it start out, I met her in a bar down in Old Soho? Because if it is, you owe some people money. I'm just letting you know.
N-O-L-A. Like Cherry Cola.
So do you need anything from us or just our enthusiasm, Rick?
I think I should just move over there, right?
Okay. Well, this is Rick, and he's going to... Rick's going to play Nola. You got some, Renee?
Yeah, just getting a little battery.
Okay. All right, so we'll play the song, and then is it showing low?
It's starting to get low.
Okay. We'll make it to the song, and then I'll swap the batteries out. So we're good, Rick.
Okay.
Just keep an eye on it for me, please, Renee.
Nola Lala. The holy hood.
some high tone party with them white line ballet girls. Lola's a creepy mama, you get what you deserve. Lola, la la. Sipping on some champagne wine.
Take a quick break, guys, and when we come back, we're going to make Rick sing for his supper. What a joy. This is amazing, Rick. We're having like our own private concert in here, man. Hey. Now, you're saying it's early for you because you're a working musician still. Mm. You're still out there gigging around.
Mm-hmm.
And so you work a lot of nights.
Mm.
Where, if people want to go check you out right now, where are you playing?
I'm playing every Monday at a place called the Red Door. It's in Toluca Lake. And it actually is funny. I've been there every Monday for a while now, and I wandered in there a couple years ago, and it's a restaurant out front, and then in the back there's this sort of speakeasy kind of bar,
mm-hmm.
and that's the Red Door. I'm walking around the restaurant area, and I hear this guy, "Hey, Rick!" I can't be me. I don't know anybody here, you know. I looked, "Hey, man, what's it?" You know, finally turn around. It's a guy, the guy that owns the place I was in a band with.
Wow.
And, you know, and he's a great songwriter, and he went on the road and a bunch of stuff. I went out with Dave Allen at the time on the road. So,
whoa.
Yeah, so we parted ways, and I hadn't seen him in like 20-some years. And there he was, wow. Doc, the Doc.
Now, so now you play there. You like every
yeah. I play there like starts at 10, and I'll play like 4 or 5 original things, and then other people will, you know, other songwriters will play, and then my friend Doc he comes out and we do some songs, which is really funny because some of them I played with him like 20 some years.
That's, what band was that, sir?
It was Doc Lawrence and the Tracers, Doc Lawrence and the Tracers. We played this place called the China Club, and it was in Hollywood, and they loved him there. He was there all the time. He was there for a number of years. And, again, yeah, Dr. John, Herbie Hancock, all these people showed up at that place, you know, so he got to open for a bunch of people.
Wow.
That's awesome. That's cool. Now, you know, Rick, you're a humble guy. So do you want to give us you already said Dave Alvin and you saw John's face. That John's a big fan of the Blasters. Do you want to give us a rundown of some of the people you played with? Well, it won't sound braggy because we're asking. But I know there's some names in there. I know
working with Dave was great because, you know, that's pretty much the Southern California roots punk scene. You know, Los Lobos and X and all those people were around him, well, you know, a lot.
Yeah.
So I was a generation before that, really. I mean, I was listening to and wanting to be like Leon Russell or mm-hmm. people like that. You know, and I was aware of Dr. John, but it took me a while to actually get to that wanting to play and trying to play that style. But, you know, I would say the Leon Russell type, or even Elton John, people like that were writing great songs and all that. And then, so I missed the sort of punk scene, but then I kind of caught up when I joined Dave's thing. And,
yeah.
And, you know, that was his crowd, you know. So John Doe. He was my roommate.
All right, here's where the rest of the show is going to be stories about you rooming with John Doe. I'm a huge X fan.
Yeah.
And they got an exhibit at the Grammy Museum. Starts this week, I think.
The memory I have of John is we were roommates because he didn't smoke. And so this was a funny show. This is like 95, 6, something like that. It was called The Pleasure Barons. Are you aware of The Pleasure Barons? Yeah, I think you'd like them, John. Okay. The Pleasure Barons were a tongue-in-cheek group of people. John Doe was there, Rosie Flores, Dave, who else was on? Who are the guys that were from San Diego they were crazy. They'd have to put cellophane or whatever on all the amplifiers and stuff because part of their
the
act
Dickies?
They're like that group.
Yeah.
They're from San Diego. I'm just spacing.
So the cellophane was to keep the...
People would throw beers at him. It was like this whole, you know, sort of, I don't know anything about this, man. I just want my stuff off stage.
You're right. By the never time the they cellophane. Come.
Yeah. And they were the headliners, you know.
Oh,
I mean,
great.
It was
who would that have been? I can't think of it. Thinking the Dickies or the Screamers or something.
I'm spacing now, but
like the Butthole Surfers or something? Or?
It's that kind of dead.
The Milkmen.
It's that
the dead kind of, Milkmen.
The
yeah.
Dead Milkmen. The
now I'm thinking, okay, comedic the Minutemen punk bands.
Now the Minutemen, he would have been the lead singer would have been gone by then.
But these were Roots guys. I mean, they actually did, you know, really cool music. They were on Letterman. You know?
Oh,
they,
really?
Yeah,
is that
they,
right?
Yeah.
So this is like after the Knitters, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like that.
Wow.
You know, kind of like that Roots thing. It wasn't his country, you know?
Yeah.
Who were your psychobilly? The Cramps?
The Cramps were great, yeah.
Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
So you got to room. See, John, I told you guys were going to.
So is that because Dave Alvin did like a year in the Innex, didn't he? He kind of filled in for Billy Zoom for about a year, yeah. Mm-hmm. Was that about the same time or a year after?
No, I'm that's 7-8 years later by the time I'm showing up.
Okay.
Because
they were such buddies, I think they kind of like swapped out.
Well, this Pleasure Barons thing was all these different sort of Southern California people that are great songwriters and stuff. And the spoof was they wouldn't go on. I guess they went on with their name, but they would all wear these cheap, like, tuxedos and stuff. The guys would, and Rosie Flores, I'm spacing on people's names, but they wore, like, party dresses and stuff, and it was like
cool.
A very 50s kind of thing.
How cool.
And it was a big spoof on Vegas kind of thing.
Wow.
So we'd all be in this big bus going around the country, and they you know, John Doe would come out and sing Delilah or something.
Oh, wow.
You know? Yeah, it was really crazy.
How about that? I never heard about that.
Yeah, and it was just something they did for fun.
Wow.
You know,
you missed out, John.
I'm surprised I never heard about that.
Are you okay? It wasn't in the LA Weekly.
Did they ever do like an album or anything like that? Anything on record?
I think they did.
Yeah?
I think they did a couple records.
Really?
Yeah.
In
the mid-90s.
Let me Google it.
Yeah.
You guys keep
Pleasure
talking.
Barons. And that will help us. If you Google that will help us find. I'm trying to think of the leader, and he's from that band that I'm spacing on.
San Diego. Crazy punk band.
Big guy. Deep voice. Country Dick.
Mojo Nixon?
Mojo Nixon was on the gig.
Oh, wow.
He was there.
Okay, well, there we go.
And Country Dick, I think, was the Country Dick Montana, I think the guy's name was.
I'm a looking.
Oh, yeah. that rings a bell. Yeah.
I'm a looking, I say it, because to keep in the country theme.
Mojo Nixon.
I'm a good host.
Got a version of Mojo Nixon doing the Grinch song.
Oh, really?
And what was the other, he was they're actually getting some airplay. Elvis is Everywhere. And Don Henley Must Die.
Oh, that's the greatest.
He did a song called
That
Don
was
Henley
the greatest. I ended up playing with him on that tour.
Really?
Yeah, doing that those songs.
How great is that? There was a story. I don't know if it's an urban myth, but there was a story. He said that one night Don Henley showed up and got on stage with him during that song. Did that really
happen? Yeah, I think he turned out to be better than even they thought.
He had a sense of humor.
There is an album available on Amazon, and it is Country Dick Montana.
Yeah.
Whoa, it's $38.99, so it must be out of print.
I love that. You know it's out of print when it's like $50.
Yeah. And it was, it just says Pleasure Barons live in Las Vegas.
Ah, okay.
But yeah, that's it.
That's it then. So yeah. You're on that album probably. Huh?
Maybe.
Live in Las Vegas.
If I spend $38 right now, you're going to get some money. You're going to get a little taste.
No, I'm not.
You get a little taste of that, Rick?
No. Forget it then.
I don't buy it.
But if he signs it, then you might.
Yeah. I don't buy it. If it's not helping Rick out, I don't buy it.
You have to get
over to Lovell's and check that out.
Well, they'll get on Amazon. The stuff they don't have, they just get online and buy it.
That's awesome. Hey, so anyone else you care to... Anyone else you care to reveal that you've played with? I know you've played with the likes of Lucinda Williams.
I never played with her.
Who was it? Bonnie Raitt?
Never played with her. Although I did. When we go to Nashville, when Dave would go to Nashville, they would all show up. You know, like Steve Earle and those people would all show up.
That's awesome. Has there ever been anyone that went sitting in the audience when you're playing where you go, I absolutely cannot play because that person is sitting. Has there ever been anyone?
I probably would have a problem if Dr. John was sitting in the room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's never happened to you? I met him,
and he was a great guy.
That's great.
And, you know, but I didn't meet him in the capacity that, hey, I'm a musician, you know, I was just a friend of a friend.
Yeah.
You don't tell him you're like him.
This was before I actually got into his style.
Oh, okay.
You know, I was an admirer of him always. Yeah. I always knew he was great, but I didn't try to learn the style when I met him.
Would you like to play
He actually played by piano.
Did he really?
Yeah, because he came over to the house I was living at.
Whoa.
Was with two other musicians, and at the time we were in a band with the first person I met from New Orleans was a drummer, and Harry Ravain. Hey, Harry. and he did one of these deals. He goes, so you think you can play, huh?
Oh, no.
And I go, well, yeah, I'm okay. You know, I can do this. I can do that. I'm going to show you somebody to really play. And I go, okay, great. So I went with him. And it was out in the valley somewhere, and we went over to Ronnie Barron's house. Now, if you ever check out who Ronnie Barron is, he's an important guy. He was supposed to be Dr. John. Mac Rebenack, who's Dr. John, was going to produce Ronnie Barron. They were contemporaries in New Orleans. And Ronnie he had a 5-octave range and a vocal. He was fantastic. And he was totally self-taught, so his fingers stuck way up when he played, but he was playing incredible. So I went over to his house. This is Ronnie. Hey, nice to meet you. He was playing with Ry Cooder at the time.
Whoa!
John's head is
about to explode.
And Joe Cocker.
It's all over. Yeah.
So I'm over at his house. He's, you know, sitting in his house, and Harry and Ronnie are smoking weed like, you know, constantly, and I'm talking about New Orleans, and this is all new to me. I know nothing about this stuff, you know. So I'm just looking at these guys going, well, I don't even know why I'm here, but there we go. He sits down to the piano. He starts playing. He started playing what I found out later was Professor Longhair.
Whoa.
But I didn't know what it was at the time, and it's just like this music that was, you know, multi-layered and incredible, and I talked to people at the time and said, it's sort of like if you know how to play let's say you're a saxophone player, and the guy you know about is Kenny G, you know? And you go, hey, you know, that guy plays, and you know, I really like the way he plays. And then somebody sits you down, and then you listen to John Coltrane.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, the instrument's capable of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Ronnie, you know, he just blew my mind, and I thought he was fantastic, you know, and followed him around for a while. And then one day he came over to the house. Harry and him came over to where I was, and this is like, again, out in the valley. Knock, knock, knock on the door. Hey, we got somebody you want. We want you to meet. Okay. Open the door. Ronnie Barron, Harry, Dr. John.
Wow.
And this is, you know, he's got the full regalia on.
Wow.
He's like, he's Dr. John. He's not messing around.
He's always, you know? Dr. John.
Yes, yes. It's like Elvis. You're always going to get the suit. I don't care where you are.
Awesome.
And he comes in and he goes into the studio. We had a studio. My grand piano was there. He sits down. It wasn't too long before he had done the last waltz and stuff like
that.
You know, so he was off of that. And sits down at the piano, and Ronnie blew my mind. Whatever was left was gone after Dr. John, because he took it even farther, you know. He took it. You know, it was just
whoa, what a moment.
Incredible, yeah.
Rick, can I just remind you that you, when we talked about you doing this episode, you were afraid you weren't going to have anything to talk about. Can I just gently remind you of that?
And now we won't let you out the
and
door.
Yeah.
We're locking the door so we get all the laughs.
Now, I clumsily tried to segue over to a song. Would you like to play another one of your originals? Or
sure.
Would you like to play for us, sir?
How about if I play just a little bit of what Ronnie played for me?
Sure.
I'll just play a little bit of that, and then I'll go into something of my own.
Okay. Sounds great. So it's going to be Rick Solomon on the piano. Rick is now, for those of you not watching at home, Rick is now settling in behind a piano that can only be described as Liberace-esque.
Yeah, yeah. He just sits down. He starts doing this. I'm going down and catch my spot. Me, my bad grabbing car. Me, we'll try to dance some good. We're going to dance some Mardi Gras.
That's awesome. That's
beautiful.
That was Big Chief, is that correct?
That's Big Chief.
Big Chief.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll see.
I'm going to ask a favor when you're done with this, Rick. And I'm throwing some cold at you, but I know you can respond. But I want to hear your original. We desperately want to hear more playing.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, if you just want to play for the next like hour, 2 hours, and us not pay you,
pretty slick, huh?
That's pretty much the music business these days, you know.
Wow. That's right. Oh, you mean like real life?
Yeah.
Well, let's see. Yeah, I'm going to do a thing over at this place called, at Paul Kulak's place, Kulak's Woodshed.
Okay.
On the first Friday of next month.
So the first Friday in July.
Yeah.
Which will be next Friday. A week from, so this episode will drop tomorrow.
Yeah.
So it'll be a week and a day from when this episode
comes. Yeah, it's after the 4th, whatever
yep,
that
yeah,
is.
Yeah, it's the 7th, I believe.
Yeah. And Severin Brown, Jackson Brown's brother, puts on this thing over there, so I'm going to play.
And what was the name of the place?
Open for him. It's Kulak's Woodshed.
All right. And where
it's
is
in,
that?
In North Hollywood.
Okay.
All right, so let me do something that I'm going to do that night. Here's a tune based on a phrase they say down in New Orleans, and they put this phrase at the end of everything. So, you know, it's like punctuation. It's like a period to a sentence. It's like, yeah, you're right.
Oh,
and it
yeah.
works in all kinds of situations. You know? Officer, yeah, you're right. Getting high to please.
I was going to ask you. Now, you turned me on to a piano player by the name of James Booker from New Orleans. And I think I turned John.
You turned me on to him.
So it was like boom, boom, boom.
Good,
you know?
Good, good.
Now, you feel free to say no, but you do a great cover of him doing Sunny Side of the Street. Can you do a little bit of that, or is that in your repertoire?
I'll do some of it. I don't know.
I know it's hard. You've told me before that is you're constantly working on that.
Yeah, and it's so designed for a real piano, and I'm playing a keyboard right now.
Yeah.
So I'll do the best I can.
No, you don't do the whole thing. I just wanted to give you a little of the. I just wanted to give you just like I love the way you do the.
And you know Booker, there's nobody like him. You know, it's like there's so many layers to.
Yeah.
It's funny because I kind of think of Booker the way, or I think of Dr. John the way Dr. John thinks of Booker.
Because on that
tape I was telling you about, he talks about James Booker and James had died recently and he was. Doing a tune that ended up on one of his records. It was his version of Booker doing Dr. John's version of what Booker would do with what's that tune? Goodnight Irene.
Goodnight Irene. That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah. And so. Dr. John goes, I can't play it like James, but I'm going to do a little thing and think of, you know, we'll just think about James.
Wow.
That's awesome.
But that's what everybody said is like, oh, man, he's in his own space.
And for those of you who want to know about James Booker before Rick gives us a little sample is I ended up, I own this documentary, but there's a documentary on James Booker and it's available on Hulu right now. If you have Hulu streaming, it's called Bayou Maharaja. And he was a crazy – he was a character. He was an insane character. In a crazy town, he was the craziest guy. So if you ever get a chance, and if you ever want to hear some amazing piano, whether you're into New Orleans stuff or not, just listen to find some James Booker. Do yourself a favor.
Yeah, and some of his stuff's online, too. You know, yeah. If you go to YouTube, you can see him actually playing the stuff, which is something I never got to be able to do until
I think there's
that
a
came
video
out.
Of him at, like, Montreux and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and he was really respected in Europe.
Yeah. Like most jazz musicians that are ignored here.
That's always the case. You go to France and they love the hell out of them.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Rick, I heard Rick do this and I was blown away. And then Rick told me, no, man, that's James Booker. You got to find the real deal.
Well, here's a reasonable fact, maybe, or unreasonable.
I'm just going to give you a little. See what I can do.
I come up with something.
Yeah. Well, you got Renee off his phone, and that never happens. So it was a miracle. And Renee only listens to EDM. He only listens to.
First of all, I listen to some
EDM. So that's an epiphany.
Yeah, no. That was great, Rick. That was amazing. And that. That was one of the things when I first heard Rick, I was like, wow, this guy.
That'll
is
get just, your attention.
This guy is just beyond. Because who's you know, nobody's playing that. Everybody's trying to do this, you know. And that's just such a beautiful rendition of that song. And there's so much musical history rolled up in his version of that. You have it's stride and it's all these other. There's like 20 different piano players in that version of that song.
That's really well said, Mario. Because that's really what it is. You open it up and you see four decades. Yeah,
and it's just all in one. Mm-hmm. And when you hear him do it, and that was like a staple in his repertoire. It's almost on every one of the recordings. Because a lot of his recordings are basically bootlegs. It's people that just set recorders on top of the piano when he was playing at different clubs in New Orleans. There's a few that he had where they were produced.
Albums, like the one you recommended was a live album.
Yeah, there's a few good, well produced, but he didn't record a lot, so a lot of stuff was just bootlegs of him. But that song turns up on a lot, and every time you hear it, it's a little different.
Mm.
Like every great jazz musician, it's a little different. But,
that's right.
Wow.
Yeah, that was amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
What can we say after that? Well, we got nothing to say, Rick. So. So Rick, when you sit down to write, like, what's it like to you know, for someone who has no concept of it, what do you start with when you're building a song?
That's an interesting question because it changes a lot. There was a thing I was trying when I was around that Lauryn Hill era. I was trying to deal where I would turn the tape recorder on and just stream of consciousness, you know, just play. It doesn't matter if it's in the wrong, it doesn't, nothing matters. It only, it's sort of like getting back to when you're a little kid and you just touch the keyboard and just get into sounds. It worked out pretty good. Most of the stuff that came out was more like instrumental stuff you'd hear in film.
Okay.
Which I actually used later because I did some composition for film. So I used some of those ideas later. But for songwriting, I got that one Lauryn Hill kind of vibe out of that by just sort of playing a groove and then coming back later and then, what does this groove sound like it's talking about? You know, you kind of ask the song itself, what are you saying? What do you want?
It's kind of like laying the foundation and then trying to see, you know.
And I know that McCartney and people like that talk a lot about, a lot of McCartney stuff was instrumental stuff first. Sometimes a year later he put lyrics to it. And a lot of that stuff that they did, Michelle and those kind of songs, were written when he was a teenager. You know, the music.
Yeah.
And then later on, you know, oh, we got to come up with a record, and, you know, hey, let's use that from.
You know, it's funny that you and John both have a love of the Beatles, and you guys know that I hate them. And yet you continue to. No, I'm kidding.
You say that.
Well, no. But when I, you know, I'll tell you what, just to go off track here, but, you know, you both, when I hear Rick talk about it from a musician's point of view, and when I hear you talk about it, John, as just a fan, it always makes me want to reconsider them. Do I? No. But it makes me want to.
It's a thought that counts.
I'm kidding. No. You know what? I'll tell you what I did. I went to Google Music the other day because you can stream it. I streamed the new Sgt. Pepper.
Oh, yeah.
And the great thing about the interwebs is I checked out the last remaster, and then I played the other one. Boy, they really remastered the hell out of that thing. That thing sounds amazing. It's amazing that it was recorded 50 years ago.
Because the thing is, they said that it was never... The stereo mix was an afterthought. They spent all this time on the mono mix, and then they considered it done because stereo was such a new thing.
Yeah.
They let some other guy take 2 days and go, okay, here it is. Here's the stereo mix, and they never thought it did it justice.
You know, I never put this together. Oh, I got the Kinks box set on vinyl. I showed you I got the box set on vinyl.
The mono?
The mono box set, so it's their first nine albums. And there's a little accompanying book, and they all talk about how, look, in those days – In the U.S., stereo had already kind of taken off in the mid-50s. But, you know, in the 60s U.K., they were still mixing. I think Ray Davies said, you have to remember, when we mixed things like You Really Got Me and things like that, they were meant to be coming out of these little speakers, this little mono tinny speakers. And that's what we...
I think even there's a Who story where they... They got like a little like car amp and a little car speaker, and they want to hear how it's gonna their latest song is gonna sound coming through that little 7-inch speaker.
Yeah,
and listen, if it doesn't sound good coming out of that, forget about it.
And that's how they're mixed,
because that's what you're gonna hear it in somebody's car or on a jukebox, and it doesn't. It's nobody's got a stereo yet.
Yeah, and so I love that. I've heard a lot of musicians say that when they hear their music back, they like to hear it in the monitors in mono. I don't know if does that make a difference for you, Rick, or?
Well, for many years, every time I was involved with recording and they were mixing or whatever, it was always take it out to the car and stick it in, you know, and see how it sounds in the stereo. And it wasn't fancy stereo systems.
You know,
it was a couple little speakers, you know, and they could make it sound good. So if it sounds great, you know, in your car, then when you take it home, put on your stereo system or whatever. Kids don't know what I'm talking about here.
Because I think in those days, most people were hearing it in their car.
Sure.
Back in the heyday of Top 40 radio, that's where you were going to hear it. If it didn't sound good coming out of your little
driving and playing the radio with no particular place to go.
Exactly. So that's why that Chess stuff sounds so great.
Yep.
It's just optimum. No matter what you play it on, it is just they figured it out.
Well, it's funny. I went and bought a Bluetooth turntable because I have a turntable that's this big clunky. I have to move it around the house whenever I want to play records and play. So I said I need something where I can just. So I put it in the hallway upstairs, and I have I have the Kinks bot set going. So I have in my little office, I have a wall-mounted sound bar for the TV. And then in my room, I have the Amazon Alexa, which is basically a giant speaker, right? And it's got, I think, six little speakers in it, so it'll play stereo. But I played that Kinks stuff coming in mono. Sounded fantastic. Yeah. It was great. I was like, this is perfect.
There, you know, I was talking to somebody the other day. There were songs that were happening in the 60s that were – I'm going to lose part of the audience here now. But that were just mind-blowing. I mean, like, you know, you're not going to like this, Mario, but when I first heard I'm skateboarding around with the little transistor radio in your ear, and I'm listening to I Want to Hold Your Hand, but it's like that.
No, I like that era of the Beatles.
But you know, it was that what sounded like punk music.
Sure.
Later, you know, I mean, that's what we would identify. It was so raw. But then, not a, you know, 2-3 years later, you got, I'm listening to, you know, just you're going about your business, and all of a sudden this thing, well, of course, You Really Got Me.
Oh,
it was incredible.
Yeah.
It was incredible. It was like so, that was like hearing Hendrix before Hendrix, you know.
Yeah, and that's 64.
Yeah, it's crazy.
That's pretty early.
What was it? You Really Got Me.
All Day, Day, and All the Nights.
Which takes it
even a little further.
Yeah.
And that's early.
Then you got those big drums. I mean, but that's Shel Talmy.
Yeah.
And I got to meet him recently.
Really?
Really great.
Okay, we want to hear all about that.
He's still around? Yeah, he's like 80-something.
I got to sit next to, Pat Francis, a host of Rock Solid, sat next to Shel Talmy when we went to see a documentary about a guy that was trying to get the Kinks to come back together.
Wow.
And here's the sad part. The movie, he has it. It's done. He can't put it out on video because Ray Davies won't sign off on the music.
Yeah.
That's typical Ray.
So what's your Shel Talmy story?
Not a big one. Just I was playing. Yeah, a friend of mine is his friend, you know, and brought him over to that Monday night thing I do.
Yeah, yeah.
And he expressed interest in doing something, so we just talked about it, and that's how, you know, I really didn't get to talk to him about the Kinks or anything.
But, I mean, he produces the first three Who songs.
Yes.
My Generation, that's Shel Talmy, and Can't Explain. Yeah.
What if Shel Talmy says to you, I've got this guy Ray, and he wants to do this album. It's Ray Davies. And he and his brother are a little contentious, but they want to do a reunion tour. Do you take it? Or knowing that you could very well, one of the brothers could try to kill you with a microphone.
Hey, it would be worth it just to watch that happen. You know?
I wonder if he's written a book. Shel Talmy, because Andrew Lou Golden has written a book. Some of these guys have written books now that they're hitting like 80 and all that.
He should.
Talk about a guy who's got a million stories.
Yeah.
Who, Rick?
No,
yeah.
Shel came from, because, you know, I get the Wikipedia stuff, so you can get into all these people that way, too.
Because he's an American.
Yeah, but he's from Santa Monica.
So I don't know. I didn't even know how he ends up in England in the 60s.
He came up and went to high school with, like, a whole bunch of other people that did stuff in the music business in the early 60s and whatever.
Yeah.
And then for some reason, I guess he felt like there was something going on over in Europe. Hey, there's something, this Beatles thing or something. I'm going to go or check that out. He's still pretty young, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing about rock and roll was a cottage industry then. You know, it was like, it was sort of under the radar, you know?
And disposable.
Like, it was not a big business then, you know? And so all these people that got in on the ground floor stuff could completely invent stuff
because
they had to.
There's no rules.
No,
you're making up the rules.
And what, they had two tracks.
That's,
you know,
right.
What are you gonna? Dave Davies stuck a pencil or whatever it was into his amp.
Sewing needles. What they say.
I love that. Because he wants to sound like Paul Burleson on the Johnny Burnett Trio, and that was like he dropped the amp and one of the tubes came loose, so they get this crazy distortion. He's thinking, how do I do that on mine? You know?
It's amazing.
Okay, let's try this again. I'm so sorry. We cut out, Rick, and I'm sorry. We were talking about Shel Talmy and Johnny Burnett and how great the Kinks are. And the batteries are a little low right now. But you have time to do one more, you say.
Sure.
What would you like to do, sir?
Can I do a little change up here?
Yeah.
All right.
And I'll, if you get a sign from me, it means the we cut out. But
okay.
And if it is, then we'll just end it here.
Okay.
So let's say goodbye to Rick. And thank you for coming in, Rick.
Thank you, Mario. Thank you, June.
Come back anytime.
Renee, thank you for producing.
Yeah, no problem.
And what's this one going to be called, Rick?
It doesn't really matter.
Oh, very nice. Okay.
But what's it called?
It's by The Who.
Yeah, right.
All right, ready? Go right whenever you're ready, sir. While you're there, I want to do a play out. Can you do, I don't know if you can pull it off the top of your head, but you do a Kink song.
Oh.
Can you do that for us and we'll play out to that? So. Renee Bravo, for the great Rick Solom, for my friend and compatriot John Sandy, we're going to say this transmission ends now, and we're going to let Rick play us out for a little sunny afternoon.
Summertime.